This episode is one that I haven't touched on, a subject I haven't touched on before, and that is incest survival. And it actually has two parts. It's all one big, long episode. It's one of my longest episodes, but I couldn't stop. It's a story that just has a lot of pieces to it. And so the other part is Nancy Allen talking about her husband's suicide. And so much trauma in this person's life, who now is super positive, has come out the other side as a human being who is gifting back, helping people that had experiences like hers, and working as a life coach. And she has a podcast, and she was just a delight to interview. And I appreciate her willingness to be so open and so vulnerable, because this is a tough subject. I mean, these both are tough subjects. Being abused sexually by your father for years, and then having to deal with the traumatic suicide of your husband, your best friend, your safety and security since you were 15 years old. So I would love for you to listen to Nancy's story, and please reach out to her and thank her for sharing her experiences. And if you are an incest survivor or know of somebody who is, who would benefit from the story and from connecting with Nancy, please reach out. And let's get to the interview now. Hi, I'm Laurie Wright, also known as Not Your Average Grandma. I created this podcast as a place to go for midlife inspiration. If you are in a stage where you believe the best is behind you, it is my hope that one of these episodes will ignite a long suppressed or unrealized desire, and you will see the potential within yourself just waiting to be tapped, so you can do amazing things with the time you have left. I want you to stop seeing your age as a limitation and start seeing it as your superpower. You have years of experience and value that a younger you never had, so it's time to lean into that and use it to fuel your future. No more letting age hold you back from the pursuit of a more passion-filled life. The more passionate we are, the better the world will be. So stop settling for average, put your AirPods in, and let this episode inspire you to take the first step in transforming your mind, body, and soul. Welcome to another episode of Not Your Average Lives. And today I have with me Nancy Allen. And Nancy and I met in a podcast Facebook group, which has been really fun. And I love meeting other women podcasters. And she has a story that is different than anything that I've brought to the podcast to date. And she is an incest survivor, and she is a life coach who now helps other incest survivors with her business, Tale of the Bell. And she might explain where that came from. So I had to ask her because I wasn't sure, but it makes perfect sense, of course. So we're going to get right into it with Nancy. She's going to be very, very vulnerable. She's going to share her story and how she used her challenges, for lack of a better word, how she used her challenges and how she overcame those challenges to actually make that her purpose, and how she is really serving in the world in a very deep and impactful way. So welcome to the podcast, Nancy.
Oh, Laurie, thank you so much for having me today.
Yes. So she lives in Northern Georgia, and I can see her beautiful trees in the background, but she is from the Northeast, where I was from, although I moved before I inherited an accent. But you might detect a little bit of her Northeastern accent. But she is now Georgian, I guess is what you say. So Nancy, why don't you just go back in time and describe what happened? You know, I don't even know all the details myself, so I'll be learning with my listeners as you share. So can you go ahead and get started with that?
So I am a father-daughter incest survivor. So it was my biological father. And it started, my father was always a disciplinarian, but a very kind, loving man. To the outside world, he was a podiatrist, and he was the kind of podiatrist that he didn't charge patients if they couldn't afford. He still did house calls, visiting the elderly that couldn't get out. So he was a very generous, kind man, but he also had his own troubles. And people today would describe him as a sociopath, but he never diagnosed. Anyway, so my father was a podiatrist. My mother was a nurse practitioner. And they worked out of the home a lot. I was initially cared for by my grandmother, and then I was cared for by my oldest sister, who's 8 years older than me. And so we grew together as kids very tightly. There were eight of us, four girls and four boys. And I was almost to the tail end. There's a set of twins that were younger than I am.
So can you imagine six kids and then have twins? That would be, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, eight kids and we're only 12 years apart from the youngest to oldest. So yeah, it is. My home life was very loud, chaotic, and but fun, you know. So we didn't do a lot outside of the family. It just was logistically not really practical. But I think it was also the way that our parents, you know, controlled us and kept us to do what we needed to do. So when I was 12, my father had a very serious heart condition. And he was actually one of the first quadruple bypasses done at Mass General Hospital. And he was in the hospital for a number of months. It put a big financial strain on the family. My mother took another job, and so she was working 3 to 11, which made it even more so that kids needed to kind of band together and keep track of things and keep the household running. When my father came home to recuperate, I was, in a sense, his nursemaid. So my mother would be there during the day, and then when I would come home from school, I would be expected to check in on him, get him whatever he needed, help him with whatever he needed. And so in that context, our relationship shifted a little from parent-child to more caregiver. And then it went further to an extreme where it started to become sexual with him. And I'm not going to get into, you know, those kinds of details because I don't think it's appropriate personally, because it's also not necessarily part of the whole bigger picture of, you know, the trauma and the healing and all of that.
So yeah, I think the point with these stories is he didn't play the role that a father should play.
Exactly. But in other ways, he was a multifaceted man, right? At times he could be caring and loving and giving, and other times he was so manipulative. And I didn't understand, right? I did not understand as a 13-year-old teenager that there was a context of this wasn't right. I was raised Catholic. See, and this isn't something you talk about, right? And there's a context of, you know, that this isn't right. It doesn't feel right. There's a gut feeling here. You know, it's not right. But there's also this other piece where his words to me were, I'm teaching you how to be with a man. I'm teaching you, this is what good fathers do for their children, that kind of stuff. And there was this emptiness and loneliness and all of that kind of thrown in on top of that from his own personal circumstances that just added another layer. So I was 13 and he recuperated. And as he recuperated, the sexual components became more frequent. I spent a lot of time hiding. I stayed at school. I would hide in the house. And that went on for maybe about 9 months or so, maybe a year. And just after I had turned 14, I was expected that I would be working with my father in his office, in his private practice. And he would have a lot of one-on-one alone time with me. And I was just really scared, just really, you know, didn't have a voice. And a teacher picked up on some behavior changes and reported it at that time to the guidance counselor, the male guidance counselor, and then kind of had me meet with the female guidance counselor. So nobody's getting anything out of me, because at this point I'm freaked out, I'm panicked, because my father had always said that if you say something, then you'll break up the family, no one will understand, you'll hurt everyone. So I didn't say anything. And I then was referred to therapy, to a therapist. And a couple months later, my mother was away on a trip. I don't remember where she was. I think she was in New Orleans. And so we were home. My grandmother was staying with us, which is his mother. And I happened to stand a weekend with my oldest sister, who again is 8 years older than me. And she asked me, why am I seeing somebody? What is going on? And I, for some reason, I felt safe. For some reason, I felt like it was okay. And so I wrote her a note and I explained what was going on. And that evening, my sister called me when she got home and read the note and said, I'm going to help you. I'm sorry. I thought he stopped with me. He told me he stopped with me. And so all of a sudden, whole nother flood of emotions kind of happening in there. Meaning, what do you mean? It's like, wait, he told me I was special. I mean, how am I not special if he was with you? And what do you, I mean, it's like he lied to me. You know, that whole realization just happened. And then the whole things just spun out of control from there, right? So she went with me to the to my therapist the next day. Therapist was, you know, shocked and in horror kind of thing. This is the time period of, you know, first year of mandatory reporting in Massachusetts. And the therapist then had me wait outside while she talked to my sister. And then it became, they call in the Department of Social Services or Children's Protective Services. And so that we met with Children's Protective Services the next day. I went back to my sister's that night and ended up having to show up in court with myself and my younger brother and sister, the twins, who were picked up by the police.
Was everybody else out living on their own by this point? Were you the only three that were?
So I had two brothers that were still living at home. One's 1 year older than me and one is 3 years older than me, but they were not deemed to be at risk. So it was just myself and then the twins because of their age.
Yeah. And I have a clarifying thing that I need to ask. Your sister said that she asked you the question, why are you seeing somebody? Were you seeing, mm-hmm. were you dating somebody else? And she was asking,
why was I seeing a therapist?
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And because there was what's going on with me kind of question, what's upsetting you, that kind of thing.
So that was probably only me. Everybody else is probably with the program understanding. So, all right.
So I remember that that night going to court because at this point, it's like everything's spiraling. I have no control. It's everything he said was going to happen is happening and I'm terrified. Right. So I just shut down. Couldn't say a word, couldn't speak literally. And I remember going to court and being interviewed, if you want to call it that, or spoken to one-on-one with a male, and I couldn't speak. And then I remember that my sister and I, the social worker basically told us that we couldn't stay in the home and I couldn't stay with her because it was the apartment over my grandmother's house and he had a key. So it wasn't deemed safe to be staying with her. So I remember calling around with her and listening, and she called, I don't know, half a dozen different people, relatives, aunts, uncles, friends, and telling them what was going on and asking them if myself and my younger brother and sister could stay with them. And every single one of them said no. So feeling completely rejected, another layer of nobody wants me, nobody wants us. This is because I'm bad. You know, this is my fault. This whole thing is my fault blowing up.
You probably had thoughts of what was happening was actually, even if it was horrible, it was better than this because now I don't even have my father who cared about me. And I mean, just crazy thoughts that you should.
Yeah, because you're a kid, right? Yeah. I mean, you're not processing this appropriately. And then you're reading everything that's happening around and they're all reinforcing it, right? Nobody's saying this wasn't your fault. Nobody's saying, you know, we're going to help you. Nobody's saying that. Instead, we're going to take you away where, you know, you can't come stay, you know, we don't want you. I mean, that kind of thing is the message that I was getting.
Protected.
Exactly. So I ended up spending a night in an emergency foster home with my younger brother and sister. And that's an ordeal in and of itself. And then showing up to court the next day, why they did not. And I remember walking into the courtroom and my parents were on the right-hand side of the courtroom with a couple of folks that I didn't know who they were. I later learned they were their attorneys. And on the left-hand side was my sister and three strangers who apparently the supervisor couldn't attend and the co-worker, so they put somebody else in there. And then there was a children's advocate and then an attorney on that side. And then in the back is my oldest sister, who's 9 years older than me, and her husband. And I was asked to kind of step up and stand in front of the judge, who's sitting at a, you know, a podium up high. And he's asking me, tell me what your father did. Where did your father touch you? What did your father do? And I just stood staring at my feet. And I was at that point convinced that if I said anything, it'd be worse. And if I, the best thing that I can do is just not make this any worse than it is. And just, I had lost my voice. So I was escorted out, and I was sitting on the bench waiting for them to finish up, wrap up. And basically, they all came out, my mother and my two oldest sisters. And then my father came out. And my oldest sister, who was 9 years older than me, basically said to my mother, don't worry, we're going to take good care of her. She's safe. They're safe. So nobody's telling me anything. But apparently what had been decided at that point was that I was going to be placed in the custody of my oldest sister and her husband, along with my younger brother and sister.
And if you don't mind me interrupting, because I think a lot of people wonder about the spouse of the molester. So what was your relationship with your mother? And, you know, I just think of as a mother, you know, it was my job to protect my kids. And some just choose to be ignorant.
Mother was well educated. She was a nurse practitioner. She was caring, but she was distant. And some of that was when we were very young. We lived with in a two family home. My paternal grandmother, and my paternal grandmother had a way of pushing my mother out and never really accepting her. And by the time that, you know, all this is happening, my mother just didn't have a good relationship, a strong relationship with her kids. I mean, we all lived together, but it was all for her about being financial and logistics and not nurturing and spending time and connecting as individuals. So it wasn't a true maternal relationship. And I never saw her as an ally. Mm. So I've actually since actually picked up the social work records from all these visits and have read through as part of my healing process. And the way that they describe her is somebody who is just flat and dispassionate. So very stoic. One of my sisters used to describe her as the Stave Puff Marshmallow Woman, where, you know, you give them a hug, it kind of goes in a little bit, and then you let go and they go right back to where they were.
Mm. So, yeah, I wonder, sometimes I think, and you know, I don't know, because I know Catholic, that, you know, it's not used birth control. So I often wonder, because I don't think I would have wanted more than two kids. But if I was Catholic and I couldn't use birth control, I would have kept having babies. And you wonder if just years and years of getting pregnant and having baby after baby, what that does to your psyche if you really don't want all those kids. You know, I just, that came to mind, and I was just thinking, you know, maybe that was a big part of her just disconnecting.
I think that a lot of it was that she just was not capable. She was not emotionally capable. And later on in my late 20s, as I was healing, and she truly stepped up for me, literally stepped up for me. And I'll get into that. But I later learned that she was an incest survivor herself from her. And so she had never gotten help. She didn't know what to do. She couldn't get to that point where, and so I was able later on to forgive my mother. But at that time, it didn't help, and there was no connection, and she was not an ally for me. So,
Was she an incest survivor, and it was her father who was the abuser too? Or
yes,
yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is a cycle, and that's part of the issue, is that you're raised one way, and I think it's much more common than people think, right? Statistically, RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, post statistics of it's 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. And in 85% or so of the time, they know they're an abuser. And of that, half the time, it's a family member. So when you start putting those numbers together, this is not that uncommon. It's just not something that's talked about.
Because yeah, it's kind of interesting because my cousin was molested by her uncle. And what's funny is she had repressed it. So she didn't really have any true memory of it because she was so, so young. But mm-hmm. it came out in therapy. So when she got to be later in life, I think she was like close to 40. And yeah. she was having trouble with relationships, with intimacy and relationships. Yeah. And so she went and she did some therapy and she did some hypnosis and mm-hmm. things came back and came up. And it created such a family issue.
Oh, it's.
I mean, it was like worse than yeah. a family issue. But what happened was people didn't believe her. Exactly. And that created a lot of turmoil. And this uncle was very well liked. And mm-hmm. of course, it brought a lot to light. And yeah. and my aunt started to think back about things that were signs. Mm-hmm. And having left, she even said that she remembers leaving her and pulling out of the driveway for like a weekend. And she had an older sister. She had two older sisters. So, and she leaving her for the weekend and feeling this thing in her stomach, like this gut. And that like, you know, just like there was something that internally said to her, maybe not, maybe I shouldn't do this, but she did it anyway. And, yeah. And so you can't erase the past. But what we can do by talking about this and sharing your story is anybody out there who has a gut that, you know, there's a reason you have that gut feeling.
There's absolutely, somebody refers to them for me as called body memories, right? It's your body recognizes or feels something or knows something or intuition, whatever you, or you're picking up on nonverbal cues. There's all kinds of things that, you know, but I believe that you need to trust your gut. And sometimes it may mislead you, but you know what? I'd rather be wrong and have taken action because of the way that I was feeling than to not take action and then regret it later. And that's yeah. just me. But
yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that there's usually something there. You may not be able to put your finger on it, but there is definitely something there that is warning you or telling you, or that feeling's coming from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, I love stories about like transformation. That's like why I do this yeah. podcast, and especially stories where people take bad experiences and yeah. recognize that it was a gift. I mean, in your case, it's so hard to see that, but that you have now this wisdom within you and this experience within you that you can actually help other people with. And I love the fact that what you do today is helping other people in such a deep, impactful way. And so I'd mm-hmm. love for you to talk a little bit about at what point did you realize, because you shared in the pre-interview that you still have a corporate job that you work on, mm-hmm. but you have this side passion that, and mm-hmm. I know it's going to be so much more than what it is today. And you're in your 50s, as you shared, which mm-hmm. I love people to share their age because we're, you know, we're just getting started, right? So I'd love for you to share how you kind of started to realize that you can take what you've learned and you can actually, mm-hmm. you're a full-fledged coach, so a life coach. So what got you to realize that that's what you wanted to do and you wanted to do this new thing, and talk about that?
So that's a long story.
I know we talked about that. We might need to do a part two. So we'll end it with dot dot dot.
let me go back just one moment I won't get into as much detail, but part of the reason that I felt the way that I felt is I felt that the court reinforced and the everyone around me reinforced that this was equally at my fault. So I lived my teens recognizing that this was at my fault because we both got the same punishment and I viewed it as punishment. I was removed from the home. He was removed from the home. I was ordered into therapy. He was ordered into therapy. And that was it. All right.
So when you say removed from the home, what does that mean?
I was placed into foster care with my little sister. So it was a kinship.
Like with
him. He was literally not allowed to be in the house with my other siblings. So he moved into his office.
So he wasn't put in jail?
No, no. And he openly in court said, acknowledged that he had done it. And he apologized in court.
So what year was this? Can you give us some?
This is 1978. Wow. And part of it was that he was a pillar of the community. He was a doctor. He was very well loved. And they really thought at that time that therapy would help him, that, you know, that he, you know, he was deeply remorseful and that he, and so it, you know, it just was, so he never was criminally charged. No. And my oldest sister was involved explaining what had happened to her in court. So it wasn't just me. Anyway, we were returned just as I was starting high school. So it was like 3 months that I spent with my older sister. And when I returned, it just quickly went back to being the way that it was, but in a different way, in that I knew I would never say anything again because being away was worse than being there. And I really blamed myself. So within 6 months of being returned home, and I was still in the custody of the state, not physical, but guardianship custody, my father got me pregnant. Yeah. And it kept escalating and it didn't stop until it went through. I put myself through college at 18. I went co-op so I didn't have to be home a lot. And I got married when I was 20. To a boy that I had met when I was 15, who was like, I was living this two parallel lives. One was with him and it was like, he was my sanity. And the other was this craziness going on in my daily life. And I found ways to cope. I found ways to escape to the extent that I could. I was very fortunate and then I was very, very intelligent. And I had teachers take an interest in me because of that and because it was my escape mechanism. You know, it was the way that I escaped into, I could focus on something. I could focus on a math problem, solving problems, and the rest of the world would just go away. And he acknowledged and appreciated education so much so that he would leave me alone. So it reinforced education for me, which then reinforced work for me. So I never became addicted to drugs. I never became addicted to alcohol or any of that. But I was addicted to work. You know, that's where I felt safe. That's where I felt connected. And I had this amazing relationship with my husband. Like I said, we were first boyfriend and girlfriend at 15. And he helped me through a crazy time in my life just by being, not necessarily knowing, but just by being there. You know, his physical presence.
Yeah, well, I apologize for like wanting to transition to what your life coach experience. Yeah. I thought like that was end of story. But yes, part two is even more horrendous that you were.
And so now it's the, and so it's like not telling anyone and just living it yourself because of what had happened previously. I just didn't. And then I just remember coming home. When I found out that I was pregnant, I was away on a school trip. And even that scenario was a situation where it became very, very clear to me that my mother was never going to stand up for me and blaming me. And so it just shut everything else down. So it became something you lived with, you coped with, and tried to find whatever kind of semblance of normalcy, whatever that meant, in any way that you could. And for me, it was escaping to school. It was escaping to college. And then it was escaping through work. And it was also establishing this relationship with an equally traumatized young boy, man, who different issues, but had his own issues. And we just kind of were two troubled kids that came together and connected. And I got married 2 weeks after my 21st birthday.
And what happened with your pregnancy?
Too much younger than me.
What happened with your pregnancy?
So that's fuzzy. I don't know if I miscarried or I don't know if it was aborted. My father worked at a clinic, and so my mother took me to his clinic. So it's very fuzzy for me, and I don't know if I miscarried or not, but in either way, there was no child. But it just continued on from there, and it became just very, very manipulative and very, very, we were cat and mouse playing. And I grew up just recognizing that nobody was going to do something for me. If I was going to do any way out of here, it was going to have to be me. And to me, college was the way out, and an income was the way out, because part of the reason my mother said at one point that she didn't leave was, how was she going to be able to afford and support 8 children on her own? Part of the reason, but I'm not sure that that was the whole reason. Anyway, I became the breadwinner, right, for our family. My husband became a stay-at-home dad back 31 years ago, when dads didn't stay home with their kids, and he loved it. And anyway, so my boys were 2 and 4 when my father died. The night before he died, he called me. He was going in for another heart bypass. They didn't think that there was a strong chance that he wouldn't make it. And he called me that night. And he said to me that he was sorry, and then he asked me to forgive him. And I remember I couldn't respond. Again, I lost my voice. And I handed the phone to my husband and walked away. And that was the last time I ever said anything to him. But within 3 weeks of his death, my father's death, I was a mess, because everything that I had gotten so good at stuffing or finding places for it, all of a sudden the safety valve blew off, and I was suicidal. I was having nightmares, that I was having flashbacks, and I had no idea what was happening to me. I just didn't, I know now that it was PTSD, and the mind kind of just now all of a sudden allowed it to come out, as what you were saying with your friend or relative. Something happened that allowed that to happen. She went to therapy, kind of thing. Here, the catalyst was my father died. So there was safe now to do, and it just exploded. So I was hospitalized in an acute
psychiatric hospital. Now, tell me, did your husband know the details of what had happened to you?
He knew the first round, that he knew that I was an incest survivor from when I was, but he did not know that it had continued while we were dating and together. And that came out at that time. And that was hard for him. And it was also the time where my mother finally stepped up, right? My mother started coming. She was down in Maryland, and she started driving, 10 hours every other week to come to therapy with me and to help me with my kids. And eventually, I finally understood my mother, and we became friends. She would never be able to be maternal to me, just because we were way past that. But we became friends, and we understood each other. And she was a great grandmother to my children. She lived with this, my husband and I, for a while there as well before she died. So we reconciled. But, it took me probably about a year and a half after his death for me to truly deal with, come to terms with, extensive therapy, 2 hospitalizations, and really coming to terms with every relationship I ever had with everyone, from siblings to grandparents to parents to, even my husband, in trying to understand, who he was and how I couldn't tell him, and, just reconnecting in that way. And I healed. So I was at that point in my 30s, or early 30s.
How long did you go through therapy for?
So I was 28 years old when he died. And I probably finished therapy, a year and a half, almost 2 years. I had an amazing boss work situation. I was a manager at the time. And I had an amazing boss who just, he knew what was going on. He came to visit me in the hospital. And he helped me tell my situation to the males in work. He accommodated everything that I needed from him. Like, I had a startle reflex at that time where I couldn't handle people coming up behind me. I couldn't, so just kind of putting in all these accommodations and having all the males in the department become aware and help. It was just an amazing kind of response. It was the first time that I ever felt really accepted.
That's great. Sounds like he was a little bit of an empath, or, he wasn't the typical male of,
Yep.
sweeping things under the
rug. That's where I learned that people can help you and will help you, mm-hmm. and how bad it really was after yeah. by being outside of the family, you know? So I was probably 31 when I finished and stopped therapy, and life was good. Life was great. My husband and I decided to really give back. We put in to adopt two children through the foster care system in Massachusetts, and we adopted two children from there.
Yeah, and we should say, because I don't think you've said while we've been recording, she has yeah. two sons that are biological, and then she adopted twin sons. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they came out of the foster care system out of Massachusetts, and they are 10 years older, 10 years younger than my oldest. So there's 8 and 10 years between the four boys.
What did your two older boys think about the situation? Were they okay to share?
Well, I mean, they were, you know, just entering teenhood, you know, they were kind of preteens, they were 10 and 12. And to them, the twins were their toys. And I could tell you all kinds of stories of craziness in that house where
poor boys, you're brave.
Yeah, but I mean, I remember my twins were 5, and I remember getting a call at work from the principal of the school that one of them had mooned his kindergarten teacher because he got mad, so he turned around and mooned her. And I'm like, okay, that's hilarious. Now which one of you two taught him that, right? It's like they knew that they couldn't do this stuff themselves, but they were teaching them everything that they shouldn't do.
Now, did they maintain a relationship with their biological mother or father at all?
Mm-hmm. No, we took them as our foster children when they were 22 months old, and then we adopted them when they were 5. And the birth parents were fighting it. So they had supervised visits at the Department of Social Services office during that time period. So they did see them until they were 5, and then afterwards they didn't. So my 30s and 40s were amazing time of, you know, my husband continued to be the stay-at-home parent. I used to say that I didn't have 4 children or 4 boys. I had 5. One was just bigger than the others. He would play, you know, he was just a big kid, but he was also very responsible. I mean, he could get kids to do amazing things. He volunteered full time at a private school that we had our twins in, and he ran their food bank. So we were always very much giving back in small ways, in, you know, one-on-one type ways with our, you know, first with our twins, and then later through organizations that we connected with and helped with. So that all kind of, my 30s and 40s were, you know, 15 years or so, 18 years or so of just pure, much more joy than not. And some of that was recognizing that, you know what, you don't sweat the little stuff. And believe me, and you don't take for granted things. And you recognize that having gone through this, right, there's very little that I can't go through that I'm not going to be okay from, or that I'm going to, you know, some of it may be a little hard, some of it may be difficult, but in the moment, in the end, there's an empowering feeling of having healed and having moved on. And I don't like to call it overcoming. I like to call it integrating, because it's part of who you are. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that too. I love that you use healed, because so many people continue to need therapy. So you like, and I remember when I had marriage counseling, my therapist said, my job is to have you not come back anymore. We're going to do that. And then it's going to be fine. And then you're not going to need it. It's not, I failed if you continue to come and every week till the end of time. I love that.
You go through life where you may need some help, but it's usually, you know, periodic time, you know, whatever. I mean, my husband and I went to marriage counseling for a brief period in there, where it was before we adopted the twins, and we were like, well, what's next? Where do we go? You know, we were trying to come to terms with that, you know?
Yeah.
So therapy does play.
Yeah. So we went twice, and it was so funny, because it was like, the first time it was me that had the issue. The second time it was him that had the issue. So it was like 10 years apart, but I guess it's like maintaining a car or maintaining whatever you need to tweak that is broken at the time. Yeah.
I think therapy is just about communication. It's about helping you get in touch with yourself, and then helping you get in touch with others that you maybe having difficulty with. To me, that's, it's all just about. So I had a pretty idyllic, what I would consider idyllic life. I was a vice president for an insurance company. I worked full time. We had moved into our second home as a permanent home and was selling the other one. And I was living in Maine, working from home 1 week a month, 1 week, and then the following week traveling down to Georgia for that's where the corporate headquarters were of the company that I had started with. And my husband was home with the kids. So I'd be gone 1 week and back 4 days, you know, Monday through Thursday. I'd go home Thursday night. And then I was away on a business trip. I was 49, 2013. I was away on a business trip and I got a call. And a long story short, but my husband had been struggling a little bit with, had some alcohol issues, and he was in therapy, but he was, you know, he had a perfect storm evening. And long story short, he was drunk, something happened, and he ended up dying by suicide. And my twins, who were then 14, found him on the floor. And I was trying to, at 6 o'clock in the morning, talking with my kids because he was still alive when they found him. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what to do. So I called the neighbor to get them help who did CPR. I'm calling, you know, 911, but we were living pretty remotely. So 911 is a 30-minute drive kind of thing. In any event, he died. And it started another round of, I mean, not only had I just lost my husband, but I had also now become a single parent of two traumatized children who, you know, not only were they special needs, but they now had just witnessed their father's death. I didn't even know the routines. I didn't know the schedules. Because that was his role. And on top of all of that, what floored me the most was, as an incest survivor, I was back to having nightmares, waking. And now I had occasionally had nightmares all along the way, but I had gotten to the point where my husband would just wake me up and his presence was enough that I was okay. You know, he'd just be telling me it's Bob and I'd be okay because I knew I was safe. Now I had nobody wake me and I could spend hours literally in the closet trying to reconnect myself. And so I had to work on strategies with a therapist on that. I went back to therapy. I actually went to see the woman that my husband had been seeing, which was helpful because she was able to help me see me through his eyes because I was his next of kin. So I could release his records. Anyway, through all of that, we ended up relocating down to Georgia because I couldn't travel 1 week and be home the week after. And so I relocated my kids down to Georgia. And
in time frame, how long ago did this happen? Just so the listeners know.
He died in November of 13 and we moved in June of 14 with my work really, again, a different company. But once again, an organization stood up and said, whatever you need, let us know. And I took them up on that. When I did start traveling back before I actually moved down, I said to the president of the U.S. office, I said to him, what I need from you is my kids need to know that they can reach me. They're scared. They need to know that they can reach me. So if my children call me, I don't care what I'm doing. I'm keeping my cell phone on. I don't care if I'm presenting to you. If my cell phone rings, I'm going to step outside and take the call from my kids. And it happened twice and it was stupid stuff, but I did it. And it was still, I had people that were, you know, they got it. It was okay. So I've been very fortunate in the way that I've had employers respond to my needs. And I know that's not very common, but there people will help you if you let them, if you, you know, truly let them. But I basically had everybody's worst nightmare just happen. And they were, you know, how do we help you? So my response to that in 2014, we moved down here and my children were really having a hard time. So my focus and my reason for living was for my kids. My kids could not have another parent die on them. They had so much trauma already in their lives between their birth parents and now their adopted father had died. And so it was whatever they need is what I'm going to do. And one of them was very, very angry for a long period of time. And it was hard. I mean, I'm not going to tell you it wasn't hard. And I was a mess. I mean, I was, but my oldest sons really stepped up. My oldest son moved back in with us. He hadn't lived in only 6 years. He moved back in to help with his younger brothers.
So, and they were 14. The twins were 14 when your husband died, mm-hmm. as I recall from our conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tough age.
So tough age to start with, and they're coming of age themselves, and they've got their own stuff about what was going on. And, but in that process, those first few years, I know that I was living for my children. You know, I was doing what I needed to do. I even had my license plate changed to the number 4 and then the first initials of each of their names. So it was because it was my daily reminder, I'm here and I'm doing this for them. And I needed that at that time. I needed some sense of purpose, and that's what it was.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, because I'm a little woo-woo and think the universe does things for reasons, and you have to wonder that they were sent to you to save you, because you had said that you yourself were suicidal.
I think it was mutual.
Yeah.
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 I really think it was mutual. I really believe in fate. And I really believe that we're all, there's a reason for everything. I'm not Catholic. I struggle with, you know, the notion of a God, but I do believe in fate and that we're all connected, you know. Chaos theory is probably more the Native American type beliefs is probably where I kind of fall in that realm. So as they got older, you know, as they started to become young men, it became, okay, I need to figure out what's next for me, because at some point they're not going to be here. And so what does that mean for me? What is it that I want to do? Who do I want to be? I was really shocked with how raw and how long my childhood demons came back and resurfaced for me. I never imagined that I could ever be in that way again, but it happened. And so it really started me thinking that, you know what, I found my voice in a way that, you know, nobody was shutting me up again, you know. Right? I found my voice and I found out who I really was in the process. I mean, when my husband first died and I bought this house down here in 2014, I couldn't even figure out what color to paint my bedroom because I didn't know what color I liked, because I didn't know who I was, what was me versus what was us. You know, it's like really trying to figure out who the heck I was. And I did. It took a lot
of work. That's so interesting, because I mean, to me, putting myself in your shoes, trying, and you having the second horrendous thing happen to you, just one of those situations alone would be enough for somebody in a lifetime. And then you have the second thing. So you've got to be thinking, why do all these bad things happen to me? But yet, in hindsight, looking back, it's almost like you needed that second journey to really find who you were. Because you were still so much leaning on somebody else instead of being who you truly needed to be. And wow, that's pretty incredible when you can look at it from that lens.
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn that my husband never kept me safe. I kept me safe.
Yeah.
He was just my mirror. He mirrored for me. I had lost my mirror, not my safety. I got a huge dog. I was always a dog lover, but I got a huge dog. She was a Newfoundland She became she was the reason that I could literally be by myself, you know, physically be by myself and be okay. And she helped me, you know, through that time period and whatever. And I named her, she was born on the first anniversary of my late husband's death. And her name was Yana, Y-A-N-A for You Are Not Alone.
Wow. It just gave me chills.
Yeah. She was a big deal. Yeah. So it was around 2016 or so, you know, a couple of years, you know, my children were stabilizing, actually more than that, they were thriving. I had gotten them into all kinds of programs. They had found a mentor who himself had lost his father and had to suicide, and had was running these experiential programs that was amazing for them. They got involved in equine assisted therapy and they started volunteering with the Special Olympics. So they flourished in a lot of, and they figured out who they were and where they, when they, and when I realized that they were okay, it was okay. I need to kind of shift for me. Where am I going? What am I doing? Because in a few years, they weren't going to be there. You know, I didn't want them to be there, right? They needed their own lives. So I started really kind of soul searching to what is this? And I believe in fate. And so I believe that there was a reason for all of this to happen. All of it, when you put the whole pieces together. And to me, it became, nobody should ever feel the way that I felt. Nobody should ever feel alone, isolated, misunderstood, different. Because like I said, statistically, there are so many of us out there that I am not alone. Right? It's just that people don't talk about it. It's still this taboo subject. It's, and people don't understand how it permeates through every part of who you are and your being in your daily lives. And I wanted to create a safe place for incest survivors to come together and share and talk and know that there are other folks around them. So I was deciding what I wanted to do and how to do it. And so first I at work in the corporate world, I created a mentoring program for my India-based colleagues. And so I started with, can I do this? Can I help women? Can I, and that worked fine. I went back to school and I became a life coach. And so it was about 9, 10 months of training. And I started doing that more at work as well. And then I just kind of put the pieces and parts together. And really what it is for me, it's about letting other incest survivors know that they're not alone and that, you know, living life through a survivor's lens will always be slightly different than, because that's the lens that you have. But that's no different from anyone who's been through anything. You know, if you're divorced, you live life through a divorcee's lens. If you've lost a child, if you've been homeless. I mean, you always have that context, but you figure out how to integrate it into who you are and recognize that sometimes the memories and the brain will do things, but you learn how to deal with what that is and you learn how to step into it. And the more that you can openly embrace and talk with others who get it, you know, then the better off you're going to be. So that's how I stepped into Tale of the Bell.
Yeah, I love what you said too in our pre-interview about how for incest survivors, while therapy is great, it's really nice to be connecting with a community of sorts. Mm-hmm. And So, yeah, I love that. And I love that the internet has been able to bring people together, like-minded people, like experienced people. And so it's funny because how this whole COVID thing has in a way isolated people. I don't feel that isolated because I have so many virtual communities that I thrive in. And so, yeah, it's really great that you have put yourself out there. I think just being vulnerable enough to share your story is amazing. And I'm sure that there's people that are listening to this who have similar stories. And it's been so wonderful and amazing to hear you be so empowered and so ready to impact in a deep way as you are in your second half. And I love that.
It's kind of funny. It's not funny, but you don't think about the challenges that you face in, you know, through this lens, right? But you always have a community, right? One of the things that I did when I moved down to Georgia was I joined a life after loss group for widows and widowers. So I connected with other widows and widowers. If you've got children, you're going to join a parents group. If you've got whatever those circumstances are in your life, you're going to find other people and you're going to connect with them. Well, you couldn't find, one of the things that I tried to do was find another incest survivors group and I couldn't find one. So it became the, I can't find it. Maybe it's us what I'm supposed to do. Maybe that's my role and then my way of giving back. And I have been amazed at the people that I've met and interacted with and the strength and the courage of not just women, but men to just, you know, stand tall. They stand big in the fight of, you know, of who they are. And
yeah, that's great. Know. So to share a little bit about your business and what it means, because I think it's kind of a, got a cool name. And you have a podcast. Yeah. I would love people to follow you over on your podcast too.
So Tale of the Bell, meaning, again, I'm a math geek, and it was the way that I found order and logic, because I think it's very logical. Tale of the Bell, if you think about the bell curve. So I think about people's heights, right? You'll have people that, it looks like the Liberty Bell, right? It's shaped like a Liberty Bell. And there's a medium in the middle, and then there's a range around that where
I'm the medium, I'm like 5'6" for women.
So they're gonna be congregated into that middle.
How boring.
I mean, I'm 5 foot, so I'm on the lower end, but you know, whatever. But so, but you'll always have people that, as you come down that curve, are going to be very, very short, right? And they'll be at the tail end. And then the other tail, they'll have people that are very, very tall, you know, 7 foot. So when you think about one person, you're one point on that curve. But when you start connecting and seeing other people that are like that, where, or that size, right, they form together and they form the tail. So it's the tail of the bell curve. And I think of this as the life experiences bell curve, meaning how a lot of people have that, there's a level of common enemy or range of what's normal, if you want to call things normal, but experiences, right? Mm-hmm. You know, kids have traumatic, teenage years, or, you know they go through, parents go through a divorce, or, you know, and those fit within that normalcy. But at the end, at the extreme end, you'll have folks who have lived a life of privilege, who have this, you know, glorious life that they've always had, and, you know, and that's what they've experienced. And then there'll be at the other end, those who've experienced extreme trauma. And I think of that as kind of where I would sit from a childhood perspective. And when you look at the shape of that curve, there's very few people sitting there. It's like, you're not going to go and walk down your neighborhood and say, hey, let's get together and talk, you know, because there are fewer of you, but they exist. And I wanted to create a way for people to find each other that sit at that tail, because you're not alone. You're not different. You're not isolated. And it's okay. There are people that do get you. So that's where the name Tale of the Bell comes from. The podcast's name is Tale of the Bell, and it's free. It's available pretty much anywhere. I've been struggling a little bit to put them out with COVID, but I'm hoping to get back in the next month and just kind of get back to my regular schedule.
And what are the topics of it, of your podcast?
So the podcast is about individual incest survivors talking about a specific topic that impacts an incest survivor, shared through an illustration of their own personal experiences. So I've covered things from dissociation, and I'll use experts to help explain what it is. Mm. And in that one, I interviewed she's a fiction writer, and her characters are her escape mechanism. It's how she dissociated as a child. It's where she went when she was being abused. And so her characters came to life, and that's how she dissociated. And now they're back in her life as an adult, and she writes, uses them as part of her stories.
That is so fascinating.
I've covered...
Wow. What interesting. I bet you're meeting the most interesting. I love that about my podcast, is that I get to meet people like you. So interesting.
You get to meet all kinds of people that do all kinds of things. I've interviewed someone. A lot of times incest survivors become very promiscuous. And so I interviewed a stripper who got out of the stripper lifestyle. I've interviewed a woman who was very promiscuous and to a detriment to herself, but seeking for intimacy in a way that she didn't understand, and had more than 500 partners in a period of a few years. I've interviewed and covered topics of telling your story and what happens when you're not believed, or telling your story and what happens when you are believed. I've had suicide was a topic that I've covered. So I've got about 25, 26 episodes out there, and I will use a therapist or an expert as a supplement to help explain something more technical and make it expand beyond an individual experience if it's meaningful and helpful. So occasionally I will do a standalone podcast with an expert.
I just had an idea that I think, I don't know, I'm always having boom, light bulbs. But yeah, I find so fascinating how much the world has changed in a short period of time. So mm-hmm. in 1978, your father was put back in a home with you after only 3 months. That's crazy to me. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to talk mm-hmm. to somebody who is in the judicial kind of realm that's mm-hmm. older. And can share mm-hmm. some of the stories and how different it is yep. now than it was then. That would be a really interesting story.
So I have talked to someone who did prosecute their father. I interviewed someone in the UK who the UK doesn't have statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. So she was 40 years old when her father was charged for what happened to her as a child. And she's written a book as well. So, yeah.
Sounds like some fascinating things to listen to over
it is.
The Tale of the Bell podcast. Yeah. All right. So I know you have another meeting you have to run to, but what
I do
you want to leave our listeners, or what do you want to leave the Not Your Average Lives listeners with? Something that, you know, I think your just story is so profound of, and you say you don't like the word overcoming, it's integrating, but how you took your past and you are so positive and you have this high energy vibe that I just love, and how you are using it to better your life and other people's lives and your children's lives, and that you're just giving back in such a deep way. So anything that you want to say to people who are kind of maybe still dwelling too much on their past and not
so
moving on?
I mean, I look at it as anybody can integrate their lives and become who they really are and do anything that they want to do. I really think it's about mindset. There is nothing special about me. I'm just an average person that found their way, and I had help along the way. A couple of things I would say is, like I said, there's nothing special about me. If I can, you can. And to do so, reach out to people to help you. And don't be afraid of asking for help. There was a time when I couldn't take my kids to the dentist because I still have a phobia of the dentist from my childhood. I had a friend do it. You know, it's like you find ways to do the things that you need, and people will help you if you give them an opportunity to. And find your tribe. No matter what you're going through, there are other people that are like you. Just find them.
Yeah. And I like what you said about there's nothing special about you. You're just like anybody else. But what I will also say is that there is something special about you that you discovered. You know, we all have something special inside of us. And the problem is we just don't recognize it. And so you're just like anybody else. But maybe you haven't found your specialness yet. And yeah, you are definitely special. So thanks so much for being here.
And well, thank you.
I'll figure out how to, you know, we're just going to either have one long episode or we're going to split it in two. So, all right. Thanks.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Not Your Average Lives podcast. If you haven't yet, make sure to subscribe on iTunes if you have an Apple device. You can find free resources and learn what else I have going on at the moment that might interest you on my website at notyouraveragegrandma.com. You can also find me on Instagram or Facebook at notyouraveragegrandma. If you liked this episode, it would make my heart so happy if you could leave me a 5-star rating. You can also add a review to let me know what you like about this podcast, which will help spread the word about it to others who need a little midlife inspiration. As always, be you, listen to your inner voice, and focus on reigniting that lost spark so you can start living your own, not your average, life.